And now, from the Little Red Songbook of the IWW, the red flag.
The worker's flag is deepest red. It shrouded oft our martyr dead. And ere their limbs grew stiff and cold, their lifeblood dyed its every fold. Then raised the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds will live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. It well recalls the triumphs past, it gives the hope of peace at last. The banner bright, the symbol plain, of human right and human gain. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here. With heads uncovered swear we all to bear it onward till we fall. Come dungeons dark or gallows grim, this song shall be our parting hymn. Then raise the scarlet standard high, beneath its folds we'll live and die. Though cowards flinch and traitors sneer, we'll keep the red flag flying here.
Welcome one, welcome all to WOB Radio. This is a broadcast of the Tacoma branch of the Industrial Workers of the World, also known as the One Big Union. Starting off with introductions today, would you like to lead off, fellow worker Marilyn?
Sure. I'm Marilyn, and I am a longtime member of the IWW, and I go by she, they. Lynn, would you introduce yourself?
I am in the IWW, and proudly so, several years. I really like WOB Radio, and WOB means the Wobblies, because he was just introducing it, but that's what the IWW people are called. And red is the red flag is their symbol around the world.
Greetings. My name's Gordon. I am a member of the Tacoma branch of the IWW, on and off since 2008. I live in Bremerton, across the Narrows Bridge in the wilds of Kitsap County, but I'm a member of the Tacoma branch, and very happily so. I'm a retired shipyard worker, and as I said, I live in Bremerton.
My name is fellow worker Noah. I use he, him pronouns. I've been in the Tacoma branch of the IWW since March of 2021. I am a producer and editor here for WOB Radio, and I'm also a delegate of our branch as well. If any of our fellow listeners are interested in learning more about the IWW or potentially becoming a member yourself and organizing your workplace. Alrighty, fellow worker Gordon, would you like to read us a section of the preamble?
Sure, I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs of the preamble, not the whole thing, because it can go on a little bit. The working class and the employing class have nothing in common. There can be no peace so long as hunger and want are found among millions of the working people, and the few who make up the employing class have all the good things of life. Between these two classes, a struggle must go on until the workers of the world organize as a class, take possession of the means of production, abolish the wage system, and live in harmony with the earth. These conditions can be changed and the interests of the working class upheld only by an organization formed in such a way that all its members in any one industry, or in all industries if necessary, cease work whenever a strike or lockout is on in any department thereof, thus making an injury to one an injury to all. Instead of the conservative motto, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work, we must inscribe on our banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wage system. It is the historic mission of the working class to do away with capitalism. The army of production must be organized, not only for everyday struggle with capitalists, but also to carry on production when capitalism shall have been overthrown. By organizing industrially, we are forming the structure of the new society within the shell of the old.
Thank you so much, fellow worker. And starting off with our labor news section today, we have a lineup of local labor reports from here around the Pacific Northwest, as well as nationally, to keep our listeners informed as to ongoing union efforts to organize workers. Coming out of the Northwest Labor Press, This is an interesting story that I've been following for a while because it involves a variety of unions organized in the same industry. There's a decision nearing on the Kroger-Albertsons merger. I'm not sure if any of our fellow contributors here might have heard about it. But basically what's happening is that two of the largest grocery stores in America, basically right behind Walmart, are planning to combine. And so while this is going to be a very profitable move for both of those grocery chains so that they
less
can kind of...
choice for consumers.
Yep.
Yes. Monopoly. But also the unions that are organized within those workplaces like the UFCW are kind of left in the air as to where their contracts are going to land. So the reason why these two grocery stores are merging is basically for the benefit of both of them. It basically is a monopolization of two of America's largest grocery chains. But the real concern is because of the unions organized within them are kind of left hanging as to where their contracts are going to end up. They previously negotiated with either Kroger or Albertsons, but now that these companies are merging, they're trying to figure out a way to keep upholding these contracts that they've just recently negotiated.
Seems like the company should be liable for everything in the interim because it's not the workers' fault, it's not the union's fault.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they have a legal contract. They better keep doing it every month.
Right. And the businesses do have the legal onus to uphold the contracts once they've been negotiated and agreed upon. This is coming from the Northwest Labor Press. On October 13th, 2022, the same day that Kroger and Albertsons announced the merger, Seattle-based United Food and Commercial Workers, the UFCW, Local 3000, and five other local unions blasted the deal in a public statement. Since 2016, Local 3000 has been collaborating with the UFCW and Teamster locals in Washington, Colorado, Wyoming, and California, sharing information and strategies when bargaining with Kroger and Albertsons. Now they're the coalition, representing more than 100,000 Kroger and Albertsons workers, is fighting together to fight the merger. So the unions are fighting the merger because it could potentially invalidate their contracts and mean that they could potentially lose their organized status in the workplace because now they have technically a new combined employer that they would have to negotiate with.
So they have to start all over again with organizing and...
Basically, yeah. It could potentially threaten the existence of those unions within those workplaces. John Marshall, Capital Strategies Director at UFCW Local 3000, said the merger will diminish workers' bargaining power because they will no longer be able to play the two grocery employers against one another. So that was kind of to the benefit was having those two companies be separate is because they could negotiate with either of them and there would be less legal and financial pushback. But now that it's become this one monopoly, they have to fight even harder just to keep their unions together. I think that this article is interesting because in the case of monopolization, of which there's been a lot written about, what happens to unions kind of ends up as like the fine print, the small text of those mergers. Often because the unions aren't at the bargaining table in this situation, it's because they're on the menu at the table.
Well, you know, my observation is that generally whenever you see mergers, mm-hmm. the only thing that benefits from mergers is the capitalist overlords.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The shareholders and, the executives.
And this is the reason why also in uber large companies like...
Uber.
You know, like Uber, but also like, you know, SpaceX, Amazon, Tesla, things mm-hmm. like that. The more and more financial capital that is hanging over their heads to fight back against them, the harder and harder it is to get a union in the workplace in the first place. Because mm-hmm. Amazon has a lot of money for their legal teams, a lot of money for union busting.
I think our listeners know that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although speaking of the auto workers, as we'll get to later, there's actually a push to organize in Tesla right now. But not to get sidetracked. In statements, Kroger and Albertsons executives have said that they need to merge to stay competitive with Walmart and Amazon. And according to grocery industry reports, Walmart sells more groceries than any other company in the United States. And this also kind of brings back why organizing in these large businesses is also really important. Because when there are these monopolies, they are able to garner as much more net profit and financial capital mm-hmm. as a conglomeration, as a monopoly, than they are broken apart. And as we see this in capitalism on a systemic level, especially, there is a drive to monopolize, to centralize more and more power into fewer and fewer
hands. All the more reason to buy super local.
Yes. but also all the more reason to try and drive the union efforts in those big businesses as hard as possible.
This is one of the reasons of that Walmart in particular likes to set up their stores in rural areas. Yes, they're in cities and they're in, you know, larger towns, but they really target the rural areas because then they become the only place in the area
where you can buy anything.
Where you can buy anything, really. And it's convenient for some, you know, but it's also narrowing your choices. If you can get, you know, boys' underwear and you can get groceries and you can get liquor all at the same place, and ammunition, by the way, you know, it makes it attractive, and people will get upset if you talk about closing the Walmart or at least bringing Walmart to a more responsible position. They'll get personal about it because they've developed a bond with the store, you know, because it represents civilization, you know, so.
Commodity fetishism, as some theorists would call it.
Yeah, well, yeah. I agree with that assessment, but you also have to look at it from a rural person or a working class person's point of view. If that's the one-stop shop that we can go to with the whole fam, you know, that's where we're going to go. And so it's understandable that they're not as, I don't know, sophisticated in their analysis of it as others are, who can see that they run the mom-and-pop stores out of business. You know, Walmart takes over. They'll even have little satellites there, like a barbershop and everything else. The whole town becomes enamored of the store.
A company town, if you will.
Yes, indeed. Except that they're not living, you know, the people who work at Walmart can't probably afford the rent, you know, that's locally available to them. That's another travesty. But yeah, the monopolization and the consolidation of businesses in general hurts the working class over the long run.
Continuing from this article here, at a town hall hosted by his union on October 26, UFCW Local 367 organizer Colton Rose said layoffs are more likely to happen in any neighborhood where both an Albertsons store and a Kroger store remain because the new company would probably consolidate those stores to save money.
Yep.
Why have two fully staffed locations if you could pay for half the staff and force shoppers to go to one store because they have no other choices, just like you said, fellow worker. UFCW Local 367 represents grocery workers in Tacoma and Olympia, Washington. In a study Rose did of Thurston County, which includes Olympia, he found that more than 1,000 Local 367 members work at a Kroger or an Albertsons store that are less than 2.5 miles away from other Kroger or Albertsons stores. 2.5 miles is one measure the FTC uses when evaluating competition. Federal Treasury Commission, I believe that
Trade.
Is.
Federal Trade Commission.
Federal Trade Commission. And so to avoid FTC scrutiny of many monopolies in those neighborhoods, Kroger and Albertsons will probably sell some of those stores to CNS, a competitor. This is kind of an interesting case study, like I said earlier, of how these larger companies monopolize to cut costs and ultimately cut the wages of workers, even those workplaces that are organized, and potentially drive the unions out of them.
Well, we should try to somehow change laws or do something to lure other competitors into the area.
Well, there used to be antitrust laws that were quite strong.
Right. Oh, yeah.
But in this country before
Ronald
the
1980s. Ronald Reagan just gutted them.
Yeah.
And a major trade union, too, PATCO.
So the current campaign against this mega merger, as they're calling it, is that the unions in the anti-merger coalition have leafleted customers and held informational pickets, which we've talked about previously on the show, and town hall meetings to explain why the merger would be bad for workers and shoppers. They also asked state attorneys general to help stop the deal. Washington Attorney General Bob Ferguson sued to stop Albertsons from paying a $4 billion special dividend to shareholders, which the companies announced as part of the merger. Ferguson argued that the payout, which amounted to all the company's cash plus additional debt, was meant to cripple the company and make it uncompetitive if the merger didn't go through. So there's essentially a huge financial incentives for these companies to essentially do stock buybacks and special dividends to their shareholders by this merger.
It's extortion in one form.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So there is currently a campaign by the unions to fight back against this, as well as ongoing organizing
so
campaigns.
Is there leafleting here in Tacoma?
I have seen some leafleting and informational pickets outside of some Albertsons and Kroger stores. Any recently that I have heard of, personally, I have not seen any. But considering that this is happening really locally with UFCW 3000 and 367, I imagine that there are probably going to be future events for that. And if you reach out to the, say, Central Labor Council here in Tacoma, which is an AFL-CIO outfit of all the unions here, or any of the other local labor halls down in Olympia, Thurston County, Seattle area, you could probably find out more information. And I would look to those Facebook or websites if you wanted to find out.
Another good source for Northwest labor news is a webpage called The Stand.
Mm-hmm. And
it's good specifically because it addresses, that's where I got a lot of the scoop about the concrete worker strike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they do a journeyman job of reporting on local labor disputes. So try their website out.
Absolutely. Speaking of The Stand, that's actually where our next news story is coming out of. There's currently a student workers union forming at Central Washington University. This is out of Ellensburg, Washington, and this was posted on November 30th on The Stand website. On Wednesday, student employees who work at the Central Washington University announced their campaign to form a union representing all student workers on campus. Working Wildcats, UAW, is working to gain union recognition for all 1,000 student employees at Central, including undergraduates and graduates, working in diverse roles including teaching assistants, dining and catering workers, resident assistants, clerical workers, researchers, tutors, and all other students working part-time jobs at the university.
Yeah, that's a scandal, the way that students are being used as basically academic sweatshop.
Yeah,
absolutely. I know that the SEIU just organized, I believe it was the SEIU up at University of Washington in Seattle that just organized a union for a lot of the undergraduate and graduate workers there as well.
That's a major because that's a nationally known college, and if they hit the news with that, that'll be a good recruiting tool.
Mm-hmm. And this is an especially powerful campaign, specifically this one that we're talking about, because it is a smaller, more rural university. It's still a pretty big university for Washington State.
Yeah.
But, you know, to have a 1,000-plus student body of workers that's organizing with the UAW.
That's significant.
Absolutely. Here's a quote. "We've had conversations with hundreds of student workers across campus, and it's clear that student workers believe we should have a seat at the table," said Daniel Hardegree, an admissions tour guide and former history teaching assistant. "We are teaching large classes of students. We're doing critical work that the university can't function without, and many of us are relying on these jobs to get by.
Mm-hmm.
Having fair working conditions is an important part of making sure that higher ed can work for everyone, not just a privileged few who have independent resources to get through school."
Amen.
And that's fantastic, because a lot of these student workers are doing it to cover the costs of having to buy
books,
room and board, tuition, the student loan debate that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
So the books are among the biggest there.
I remember going to, I'm not to put them on blast, you know, don't libel and slander me, please, if any lawyers are listening. But, you know, I remember just going to TCC, Tacoma Community College, and remember I had to spend probably as much on books as I did per class per quarter.
Yeah.
And they were all from Pearson, weren't they?
Some of them are from Pearson Publishers. A lot of them are basically just slightly updated course books that they put out every quarter.
Right. You've got to buy the new textbook because you have the computer code in there.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, we're not even talking about yet those students in universities that as part of their practicum are required to teach or be teaching assistants.
Mm-hmm.
And they're basically getting free labor from those people.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another example. We've talked about nonprofits before, right? Colleges and universities are kind of in that category that people think that they're some kind of holy body, that you should be grateful for working for a college or university, just like for a nonprofit, like, you know, one of the many that don't pay their workers right. But it's that thing, you're so ungrateful, you know, you terrible student, that you're disrespecting the university. And it's not that at all. These kids need to eat, and they need to have a roof over their heads. And if you're not getting paid right, it's hard for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. And considering that there is so much that they are at stake for in terms of being able to pay for room and board, being able to pay tuition, student workers are an especially vulnerable class of workers.
Yep, for many
reasons.
Because,
like Marilyn said, people who are getting teaching degrees, people who are doing research-related work, especially in the STEM field, stuff like that, they're both guilted into basically, well, you have to do this work if you want to get through your major, but you can't be organized, quote-unquote.
Right.
And also, you know, there's this onus of you're working for a university, you're working as part of bigger than yourself, you know, right. You should be grateful to contribute to this. But
it's
at the end
a
of the
way
day,
of keeping people off balance and subservient, and you know what? It ain't going to work forever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, museum workers, too. Recently, we've seen museum workers organizing.
They finally organized.
That's plenty good in my book, because these are workers, too. Just because they're working for the art museum, which has benefactors, you know, doesn't mean that they can work for free.
I heard that announcement, I think it was NPR. The Tacoma.
Yeah, it hit the big time. This is like a domino falling. Imagine a museum of modern art in New York, the Smithsonian. Imagine these big museums taking a clue and organizing. They're afraid of that.
This is coming out of portside.org, which is also another news source that we like to rely on for pro-labor news. This was posted on November 28th, so this happened really recently, fellow listeners. Quoting the article here, "To unionize, Tacoma Art Museum Workers United, TAMWU, needed the majority of its 26 workers to vote yes. After 2 days of voting in an election overseen by the Washington State Public Employment Relations Commission, the unanimous results came this Thursday evening, 26 in favor of unionizing." So it was a unanimous vote.
Wow.
Solidarity.
"With the vote, the union will join the Washington Federation of State Employees, AFSCME Local Council 28, also known as WFSCME, part of the nationwide American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees." So that's AFSCME. Mm-hmm. They are specifically organizing with AFSCME Council 28, which is part of WFSCME, Washington Federation of State Employees, which represents some 10,000 cultural institution workers nationwide. "Significant about TAMWU's bargaining unit is the inclusion of employees from multiple museum departments." And this is their one big point of contention during their organizing campaign. And this was also part of the interview that we did previously. "Museum workers across the country have struggled to bargain as a whole and have been split into separate unions. Often workers at museums are separated into unions based on positions, like the security guard union at the Seattle Art Museum and at the Fry Art Museum." So
what we're talking about is industrial unions.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, that is a wonderful thing.
Yep. And it's just like with the student workers as well. There's a whole body of different people doing different quote-unquote crafts or trades, as the trade unions like to classify them. And they're often split up by their employers, often without their desire, into different unions, so that they have different bargaining units that they can essentially wedge against each other when they're arguing for better wages, conditions.
People are wising up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's pretty cool to see a lot of the influence of industrial unionism in a lot of the larger unions, like AFSCME or WFSCME, or especially the UAW as well.
They're much more powerful.
Absolutely. And I'm really appreciating that kind of shift in the labor movement over the past 2 or 3 years, because I think the workers are beginning to realize that industrial unionism is the much stronger bargain to fight for. More from the article here. "The union feared going through the NLRB because it could divide the rank and file and possibly exclude visitor service employees who interface with the public and project art from being under the same bargaining unit as the administrative professionals. Workers said that they wanted to unionize to better ensure working conditions and pay. Visitor service employees are one of the lowest paid and most diverse groups of employees in the museum," said Patrick Sergiu, director of communications with AFSCME Local 28/WFSCME. Quote, "If you're forming a union, you might as well form it with the people that need it most and not exclude them." That's the perfect headline for this organizing campaign. I've personally been to a couple of their rallies, as have you, fellow worker Marilyn. And I know a couple other fellow workers from Olympia and Seattle joined in those protests as well. The board of the museum had kind of intentionally and strategically ignored them for as long as possible until eventually they forced them to go the NLRB route and say, "Well, we filed for an election. Now you have to sit at the table. Now you have to let us vote."
Yep.
So, and the reason why they wanted to avoid the NLRB was because, like I said earlier, that could potentially divide them into different bargaining units, and they wanted to organize as a whole.
Yeah.
They've been fighting for recognition since October of 2022, so this has been almost a year and some change in the works. In July, they began negotiating the terms of an independent election with the museum's board, and then eventually they had to go to the NLRB election because the museum's board just straight up ignored them. So this is actually a pretty big organizing campaign specifically here in the Tacoma area that I think a lot of our listeners might be familiar with. I'd love to interview them again in the future to hear about the whole process again, because the last interview we did with them was when they announced their union drive and were starting to pressure the museum board in order to have a voluntary recognition rather than a vote.
Well, so, you know, you could interview Remy. He works for them.
I think I did interview Remy previously. I'll have to check the previous episodes. But yeah, no, this is a really cool organizing story.
You know, it sounds like the board thought that they were too big to fail.
Yes, or that they could ignore the museum workers because they aren't important enough to organize, and, you know, we treat them well enough, in quotation
marks. Yes, we're all like a big family here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To go ahead and give us one more labor story here. And this one's particularly interesting because this is a segment of workers that doesn't get talked about a whole lot. And this is casino workers. Las Vegas casino workers won a big deal that averted their strike a couple months ago. Although this article was posted December 1st on northwestlaborpress.org. One by one, the three biggest casino operators settled in the final days and hours before a planned November 10th strike that would have shut down almost the entire Las Vegas Strip, 18 casinos in all. Ratified by margins of 99% November 20th through 22nd, new contracts with Caesars, MGM, and Wynn will increase pay 32% over 5 years for over 40,000 workers.
I'll take a piece of that action.
Raising pay from an average of $26 an hour to $35 an hour.
Well, there you go.
The first of the annual raises will be 10%. The contracts will also establish more humane housekeeping room quotas. Unite Here, Local 226 and Local 165 called them the best contracts ever.
And I love Unite Here. They're an incredible outfit.
Absolutely. I know that the Unite Here Local 8 did some really great organizing with the sandwich workers, I believe, about a year and a half ago. And I believe that they won their organizing campaign. And if the strike had gone forward, this strike in particular with the casino workers, it would have been the largest hospitality worker strike in U.S. history. Negotiations continue for 24 smaller casinos on the Strip and in downtown Las Vegas, including Circus Circus and Trump Hotel Las Vegas.
Yay.
I can't wait to hear it. This is also a pretty cool news story because through a couple of independent publishers that I follow on social media, there were actually protests. There were actually walkouts and brief strikes over this.
Mm-hmm.
Not officially called on by the unions themselves, but by the workers and organized by the workers.
Direct
themselves.
Action gets the goods.
Mm-hmm. It was a very direct action, very strike-motivated team. I believe thousands of workers mobilized during a couple different days.
Mm-hmm.
The police, of course, rallied them up and threw a bunch of them in jail because they were blocking traffic and things like that. But this is pretty big. And I think it's unique because, and I'd love to touch on this in a future episode, I have spoken to a handful of workers who work on, say, Indian reservations here in the Pacific Northwest, where in the state of Washington, gambling is only legal, is essentially only legal on those reservations. So on one hand...
Except for the state lotto.
That's right.
Well, that also. But it's kind of interesting to talk about casino workers because in Las Vegas, it's, especially in the state of Nevada, it's widely legal to have casinos and gamble. But in a lot of more marginalized communities, like on Indian casinos, the casinos are kind of their biggest source of outside income for those institutions and for those communities. But that also makes them much more vulnerable to be exploited by their employers.
Well,
and I'd love to talk about it in a future episode.
Yeah, the only point to raise there is that for the purposes of the gambling laws and everything, that's where the reservations become sovereign nations in a sense.
Right.
Okay, so if the employees organize, they're going to be bargaining with their own tribal government.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are progressive and some of them are very conservative.
Right.
So you got to wish them well. It'd be great to see, you know, these casinos, because they are big money makers.
Mm-hmm.
And they can really help the people who live on those reservations. So,
well, you know, side note, our local Puyallup tribe built the giant casino, the big new one.
Yeah.
And that has been roundly criticized by a lot of tribal members because it has been a big money loser.
Has it?
Yeah.
So their management is incompetent.
Well, probably. The decision to build that big was very questionable.
Mm-hmm.
They were hoping for bigger traffic than I think that they were getting.
More than the big casino that I see on I-5? Another new one?
I don't know what the cost was to build that when they built it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's variables there that we don't know.
Sure.
But within the tribe, there's a lot of noise about
that. There's some dissension about it.
A lot.
Hmm. That's encouraging to hear.
Yeah.
Because like I said, the tribal governments can be just as corrupt as state and local governments, or they can be a real force for good. So let's hope that it pans out on the good side.
Absolutely. And I think in the context of casino workers especially, it just goes to show there are these entire industries or sub-industries of workers that we don't typically think of when we think of the word unionized or organized.
Well, you know what? Let's start thinking about it.
Absolutely. And I think this draws
attention. An outfit that I used to volunteer with, Jobs with Justice, and you're familiar with I think it's Trabajos con Justicia up in Bellingham.
Yeah.
Yeah, same state.
Familias Unidas.
There we go. The whole thing was organizing those different types of jobs that traditional craft unions never bothered with, which, of course, is also the history of the IWW.
Well, absolutely. Another point about that, it was also another big, well-recognized union, not like when we were doing the grape boycott back in the 60s, but the United Farm Workers is a big player now.
Yes, they are.
And they did not recognize those berry pickers up there in Mount Vernon and in Bellingham because there just wasn't enough money in it for them.
Yeah, there wasn't a large enough pool of workers.
That's it. They have their expenses, and they like actuaries, they will say, well, how many members are we going to get? If we're only going to get 100 members out of this, it ain't worth our time. And so they organized themselves. And they organized themselves largely along anarcho-syndicalist lines, which I was really, really pleased to see.
Yeah.
And they're good folks up there.
Absolutely. I think with this last labor article, you know, if I could invite a question to the listeners, it's what group of workers do you think of that might be easily exploited or that might need a union, but we don't typically think of them as being viable for organizing, whether it's a small mom and pop shop, whether it's a class of agricultural workers that isn't big enough to be covered by the larger craft unions, whether that's things like housekeepers, student workers, museum workers, things like that.
Sex workers.
Yeah. Sex workers especially.
Indeed. And there's a stigma attached to that.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why they can't get organized as easily as some other workers.
That's right.
Let's face it, that work exists. That work pays for their livelihood, and they deserve protection, and they deserve safety.
The other one that doesn't get organized and is in real need of organization is nannies.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Fellow worker Lynn, you had a comment?
When I was in Washington, D.C., and I know it's not unique to this this hotel or Washington, D.C., but I got to, I'm fluent in Spanish, and a lot of the maids, the housekeepers were Spanish-speaking, and I was asking them about their jobs and, you know, whether they were well-paid, and I learned that the management knew who was legal and who wasn't. The illegal workers made several dollars an hour less
than
the ones, and I just went, I'm so naive, and I went, what? Mm-hmm. But yeah, they know who they are, mm-hmm. and they allow it, and...
Because it makes money for them while also putting the impetus of responsibility and quote-unquote being a good worker on the undocumented workers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They get swept up and the company just goes on and hires more mm-hmm. of those.
Well, that happens with nannies too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different classes of workers out there that need to get organized for their own benefit.
You just think about caregivers in a care facility, for example. Way more patients than they can really get to in a reasonable time. And people wait a long time mm-hmm. to use the bathroom and to be assisted. And those workers have to do whatever those patients need. And a lot of them are dying and they just have illnesses. And they can imagine. And these people get... like, you know, $8 an hour or something like that. In the South, $3 an hour. Maybe.
Yeah, they're considered unskilled. It's highly skilled when you think about people's lives.
Have to transfer people mm-hmm. and stuff.
And they're often too understaffed or overstressed to even think about organizing in the first place.
And if someone
doesn't
come in, they have to work a double shift because
mm-hmm.
there have to be certain staffing levels, which they ignore.
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah, our old friend, you might remember Adam Case.
Oh, yeah.
Well, he's a business rep for SEIU Home Care.
Oh.
Out there in Bremerton.
Good.
I've seen his office. I was trying to take it over, but he got a little antsy. But he was a former Wobbly. I don't think they let him double card in, I think, his union's SEIU. Yeah. But anyway, speaking of that, they are specifically set out to organize home caregivers.
That's really cool.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. That's definitely an industry that needs to be organized for the sake of those workers.
But it's hard to contact them. I mean, you know, the union people can't get their home addresses and stuff like that, right? How do they reach all those people that work in, you know?
Right. You kind of have to do the networking yourself from workplace to workplace to workplace and try to get them under one bargaining unit.
Well, this is what fellow worker Marcus was dealing with, was if you have a work where everything is decentralized and people are part of that company all over the country or all over the state, how do you manage to reach and organize them? But that's a different topic. So turning now to environmental unionism, I've been checking a few things this week. Some things are local, some things are national. The first thing I wanted to talk about was West Rock closing down. West Rock is the entity formerly known as Simpson Paper here in the Tide Flats of Tacoma, Washington. It is shutting down shop. It's in the last phases. You still see some smoke coming out of the facility, but it's just part of the shutdown. They had hired some 400 workers here in Tacoma. And due to the fact that we care about our environment here in Western Washington, supposedly, they have found it too onerous and they are moving elsewhere. They got bought up by another company. I started to say country, but I think companies now are more powerful than countries.
Mm-hmm.
They are moving to the Southeast United States where they have better access to lots of trees and lumber and will be leaving. And it's an interesting dilemma that we've got there because on the one hand, I feel very bad for the 400 workers that are getting laid off. But on the other hand, we need to start taking climate chaos seriously and polluting industries seriously. And I would love to have a little conversation about that later in this broadcast. So let's think about that for discussion. So that's our local news, very local. And then this one is very interesting. This is a piece of good news. The title is from The Lever. It's the title of the article is "You Love to See It, Mining Towns Get Clean Energy Boost." And what they were talking about is clean energy manufacturing projects are headed to former coal towns. California farm workers scored their first labor win under a new landmark law. From coal to wind turbines. Millions in federal funding are going to former mining towns and other communities once reliant on manufacturing and fossil fuels to pay for new clean energy manufacturing projects in an effort to bring new renewable jobs to United States industrial heartland. The U.S. Department of Energy announced this week that it was awarding $275 million to seven different manufacturing projects. Funding that comes from President Joe Biden's 2021 trillion-dollar infrastructure deal. So in Louisville, Colorado, Vandergrift, Pennsylvania, two former coal towns, old factories will be used by a windows supplier to manufacture insulated glass that helps make buildings energy efficient. In Pittsburgh, a magnetics company will build a new factory to produce components for electric vehicles and other electric infrastructure.
Yeah, very important.
Yeah. The funding will also bring a wind turbine producer to Vernon, Texas, a former mining town, a metal manufacturer to Weirden, West Virginia, a battery electrode manufacturer to Bridgeport, Connecticut, and a glass manufacturer to Detroit. Such projects are expected to bring new jobs to their chosen communities, some of which have been hollowed out by nationwide decline in mining jobs. In West Virginia, for instance, manufacturing company Boston Metal expects that the project will create more than 200 jobs. In Pittsburgh, magnetics company CorePower will employ between 25 and 50 workers. It doesn't say how many lost their jobs, but in the coal mining industry. The initiative, proponents hope, will prioritize workers at risk of being left behind by the transition away from coal and other fossil fuels, giving them jobs while also supporting clean energy manufacturing in the U.S. While the U.S. has lagged behind globally in this industry, investments by the Biden administration in particular, courtesy of the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, have spurred new clean energy production across the country. With this new funding, mining towns will now reap some of those benefits. Now, to go back to my first post that I made about WestRock and its closing down of 400 workers losing their jobs. What the city of Tacoma is seeking and hoping for is they want another company to move into that area that is, quote, less polluting, but also at the same time is a major user of water because they want the revenue from the water. So I wonder, can you have it both ways? We can talk about that in a few minutes too. So the last thing I wanted to talk about, and it's kind of with a heavy heart that I'm bringing it up, is here we are in climate chaos, and there they go again. We have our climate rocking and rolling and reeling and quickly becoming more and more urgent for us to deal with, and we have wars continuing. And the reason why I bring that up is because waging wars, exploding bombs, transporting military equipment halfway around the world, what they're made out of, what fuel they use, all of this exacerbates the climate crisis. Of course, the loss of life is horrible. What's happening to the Palestinians is horrible. What's happening to the children is horrible. But on top of that, we are blithely marching into oblivion for all of us. Militarism is ecocide. So those are the three things. And I'm sorry to end on such a negative note, but I wanted the group to discuss possibly the issue with Tacoma City Council and what they're looking for to replace WestRock, the effect on the workers, what can be done, what would be the ideal use of such property. Mm-hmm. Just people's thoughts on that.
Well, I think from a local perspective, and this is also to give context to the polluting part of the WestRock facility that used to be down there. A lot of the big reason why Tacoma even had an aroma was because, and this is from an earlier Tacoma Weekly, and I believe it was the Seattle Times that reported on it as well. The reason why it smelled so bad from that paper manufacturing facility was because they just chose not to update the air filtration systems out of their smokestacks so that they released more sulfides into the air from the paper production process.
That's one reason why they're moving.
Yep, and it was literally, they were being fined millions of dollars a year, the company, to essentially pay fines to the EPA to allow them to not update their filtration system.
Right. Yeah. So now, okay, we get rid of the stink, but the whole planet breathes the same air.
Right.
It just goes to South Carolina where there's probably, or somewhere in the South, I forget which state, where there's probably even less regulation.
Mm-hmm. And that happened with the ASARCO smelter in Tacoma as well. ASARCO, the company, moved most of their metal smelting and manufacturing facilities further towards the American South and into Mexico.
I know.
Yeah, where regulations were less tight at the time when the smokestack in Ruston went down. I think that in terms of future use, I mean, we already have the LNG plant. We already have the immigration detention facility down in the Tide Flats as well. I don't think it's going to be a project. Hopefully it will be a project that will be more friendly to the environment. I mean, who knows? They could turn it into a park. You know, they had Gasworks Park in Tacoma. Maybe we could have Paper Park here in Tacoma. I mean, sorry, we had Gasworks Park up in Seattle. Maybe we could have Paperworks Park in Tacoma. But in terms of having access to the water and the environmental impact of that,
they want a major water user.
Yes. The problem there being that a lot of the water we get is from the Puyallup River, from filtration and purification stations further upriver that later gets channeled down here to Tacoma.
And from Green River, too.
And from the Green River. Both of those rivers come from Mount Rainier, and Mount Rainier has faced such a loss of overall permanent glacial ice. It's 10% a year for the past several years, mm-hmm. the overall ice pack on the mountain. It's becoming even more difficult just for people to climb it because the crevasses on the side of the mountain are becoming so large because there's such a loss mm-hmm. of ice. I mean, that alone is kind of a good indicator that things locally are not looking well climate-wise. There's still a good aquifer here is kind of the upside. There is still a good water table coming off of the mountain, but over the next 70 or 80 years is expected to decline pretty significantly.
I don't think the city council thinks 70 or 80 years in the future.
No, they think in terms of 4 or 8 years in the future.
Yeah. Election cycles.
Bingo. Yeah. Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on this, Gordon?
Well, a couple of thoughts just to back up your point about visible climate change.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I live in Bremerton, and one of the views that I have in Bremerton is of a part of the Olympic Range.
Ah.
And when I first came to town over 30 years ago, there was snowpack and glaciers on top of, they call them the Brothers, mm-hmm. which is just a couple of these mountains that are part of the range.
Yeah, I climbed them last summer.
Did you?
Yeah, I did.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But they're losing glacial ice pack like crazy, and I could see it
mm-hmm.
because, and I wrote to Dar Jamil. He put out a public call for comment. Yeah. How does climate change affect you? And I wrote, you know, coming home in the hot months of the summer, I would be able to look up
and see the snow,
and see the snow, and just get completely, you know, psychologically cooled off.
Mm-hmm.
And nowadays, it's gone. It's gone by June or July.
In the Cascades, I was really noticing that this year, too.
Oh, yeah. Remember a couple years ago when it was in the hundreds for days? There was virtually no snow visible in Mount Rainier.
Mm-hmm.
It was really something. I was up at Glacier National Park on a cruise in 2015. They hardly can call that anymore. It's just
right.
Just receded mm-hmm. so much.
No Glacier Park.
Yeah, I was, incidentally, this week, a huge iceberg broke off from Antarctica.
Oh, yeah.
A huge piece of the ice shelf.
I've heard that every few years, like the size of Maryland or something.
No, this is bigger. This is bigger. This is the size of Manhattan and
right.
most of a lot of New York. It's enormous. So we're definitely going to see a rise in ocean
and
level.
To your other point about the fate of the 400 workers that are being mm-hmm. laid off. Well, I don't hear much about it these days, but a few years ago there was big talk about just transition.
Exactly. That's why I read that second article.
Yeah. And to address that, it needs to be emphasized again, because what does happen? Yeah, I worked in a shipyard for 30 years. That doesn't mean that I supported all the policies.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that I was part of the company. Mm-hmm. I was a government facility. But what I'm getting at is that it's not the workers' fault that they're working in a dirty industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and to just get on your high horse and just in the name of environmentalism and shut down entire industries, what happens to these workers? That's where the just transition concept
yes.
comes in.
Now, they were the just transition specifically was about coal and petrochemicals.
Yes.
But
you can extend that into all industries,
though. Right. That would have to be extended into something like a paper-producing entity.
Mining,
yeah.
paper production, any kind of.
So whether the state of Washington could apply for some money from that grant that they're doing to help out the workers that are being laid off, whether the city of Tacoma will lift a finger to do anything.
I kind of doubt that.
Yeah. I mean, 400 people, that's a lot.
It is. And the ripple effect.
Exactly.
You know, and that affects everything. The kids that are going to school.
I was down there in the Tide Flats the other day, and I smoke. So I pulled in to a little res stop to get some cigarettes and drive up. And the guy was saying, oh, it's been really slow here since people have lost their jobs.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I said, even for addictions? You know, but yeah, everything is slowing down.
People will put off buying groceries. They'll put off buying, you know, fun stuff. You know.
Go ahead, fellow worker Lynn.
I don't remember where it was. A meteorologist moved from where he'd been, somewhere in New York, I believe, to another state, and he was employed by a TV station and in an unknown city that I can't remember. He tried to teach about climate change and just little increments. He tried to be educational to people and appeal to children as far as, you know, the way he described things. And anyway, he got death threats for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And finally he quit and just moved back to where he was from.
Yeah, because he was reporting on climate change.
Yeah, tell
people
him the
don't
truth.
Want to know.
Oh,
it's the doxastic anxiety. That's one of my favorite terms.
It's the what?
Doxastic anxiety. Okay. It is the it's an anxiety about information that you don't know and that you choose not to know. A prominent example of this is with people who are trying to quit smoking, and especially with the tobacco industry. As long as the doxastic anxiety of, well, there's not conclusive tests that prove smoking causes cancer, then smokers themselves don't have to look at that information. They can be comfortable with it. Another industry where that also exists is things like gun manufacturing, and especially with the climate crisis, I think a lot of people, even well-meaning, you know, liberals and leftists that I've personally interacted with, they kind of have this doxastic anxiety of, well, we can still take care of it in 40 or 50 years, or maybe in 25 if we do something really radical about it. And I don't think it's sinking in for a lot of people that the worst that's yet to come is kind of already here. Half of the coral reefs on Earth are dead. The marine life projections are even worse than that. The ocean is becoming so acidic because of the absorption of carbon dioxide into the water is becoming so bad that a lot of the fish populations can't survive. They're too warm to breed.
There's annual fish kills.
Mm-hmm.
I keep thinking of back when I was still doing mental health counseling with kids.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what year this was, but I remember a young boy in my office bursting into tears, and I asked him what was wrong. And he was referring to the looming climate chaos, and he said, I may not live long enough to become an adult because of the way the climate is changing.
Yeah.
And that was years ago.
It's a debt that gets passed on to the
and
next generation.
You can call it doxastic anxiety.
Willful ignorance.
Or kick it down the road mentality. Or I'll think about it tomorrow, like Scarlett O'Hara. People get overwhelmed. People don't want to think about it. But it's here. And it's not 50 years down the road. It's now.
Right now, yeah.
And we're still blowing up things.
I think in my own lifetime of the 26 years that I've spent here on Earth, I think one of the biggest ways that I've noticed climate change in my own life, and this is kind of to your point about the Olympic Mountains, my dad, my brother, and I used to go skiing every year. And, you know, we still try to do so, but the snow seasons have been more scattered and more poor.
Yeah.
The amount of snow that has to be on a mountain to be considered quote-unquote good enough to ski by a lot of people to avoid things like rocks and ice patches and potentially dangerous conditions has gotten worse and worse and worse. And I haven't gone skiing in the past 4 or 5 years just because the snowpack
isn't there. The Olympic Winter Games.
Mm-hmm.
If they're having a hard time finding a place to have them.
Yeah. And of course, you're not allowed to protest the climate during the Olympics. So.
Well, they had fake snow, didn't they? Some of those Olympics.
Yeah, they have a lot of
Chinese ones.
Snow. Yeah.
They had an entire building that they had purpose built for the games that was an internal ski resort. You know, it made enough snow and it had, you know, ice skating rinks and things like that.
So here's my dilemma personally. I know all of this. I know what's happening. But I keep looking for bright spots just so I can continue on. I have many friends that are completely hopeless about the future of human life, at least, on the planet. It takes the energy away from continuing to try and work to try to make some positive change, whatever change is possible, in terms of addressing climate chaos. If we do nothing, we're assured absolute disaster.
And a lot sooner.
Yeah.
I got a ray of hope for you.
What's that? I need a ray of hope.
Okay. I watched a show recently on PBS. Yes, I'm a PBS watcher. But anyway, it's something like Indian Country News. Have you ever seen that?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I saw this program where two projects were going on. One of them was solar power for this reservation. And I think it was Pine Ridge.
Oh, they're doing some amazing things. They're doing with hemp, too.
Yes, hempcrete and things like that.
Yeah.
And so this was totally tribal, self-organized, and they are building solar power stations on the res so that they can get off the grid because they know what it's doing. And another thing that they were doing was building shelter that, you know, suitable for a family. Or you can hook them together. And how they were doing that is they were using a cylindrical concrete form and an inflatable bladder on top. And they were actually pouring and spraying concrete into this thing. And when it sets up, they just take the, they deflate the dome and they remove the concrete forms. And there you got it. It looks like a little silo or an igloo.
Looks like a little igloo.
Yeah.
I saw that too.
Did you? That gave me some inspiration because that, once again, this was all tribal run, tribal organized, and using as many local materials as possible.
I think that is wonderful. And I also think it's a good sign about the Biden money going to retrain workers in green jobs.
Yeah.
Although sometimes we get a lot of greenwashing blowing our way.
True. But incremental change is still change.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think we still have to keep fighting the machine.
I think the one thing that can also add another ray of hope to this, and this is kind of more on the spicy end of the discussion, is that a lot of environmental activists and organizers have come to what I believe is the correct conclusion that we need to escalate our tactics. Pressuring the government through petitions or voting for the right people, things like that. Incremental change is a good thing, but in terms of boots on the ground, rank and file action, I mean, you know, we could talk about the people spraying orange paint on car dealerships or mega yachts and things like that. That's a form of direct action that I think can be effective. It's annoying enough to the point where you have to focus on it. That's why they block the traffic, right? You can't ignore an entire line of people blocking traffic in a downtown metropolis because then everyone has to focus on it. I think that's a good escalation of tactics. What a lot of people in Europe are doing, and I've mentioned this a couple times previously on the show, the last 50 years of climate activism have not come to any level of change that is necessary, and it's the methods and the tactics that we're using that are wrong. Those climate activists in Germany who blocked an entire coal field for like 48 hours or something like that, tens of thousands of people swamping this entire industrial area and physically disabling and shutting down equipment.
Right.
That is a tactical advantage. So yes, vote for the vote by all means. Vote and petition in favor of the climate. Any incremental change is good, but if you actually want to like interrupt the systems that cause climate chaos, you're going to have to be more disruptive than we already are.
And I think that, you know, as the reality sets in, it's just so evident, and let's say people's favorite species disappears, you know, it gets more personal in different ways. I think that a lot of the politicians and people who do make decisions will come around. I mean, not fast enough, perhaps, but I think that there will be a groundswell of, and then that's maybe my offering of glimmer of hope.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think that, yeah, with people protesting, growing numbers of people, different types of crowds protesting the way things are and the slow pace, I think that that can, like many revolutions, have big effects.
It's the smaller actions that lead up to the bigger action. Absolutely.
To your point, we're seeing more labor activism for progressive causes.
There you go.
We're okay, what the UAW just did with the great contract wins against the big three, right? They also wrote into their new contracts of just transition-like phrases that say, okay, you know, we're going to be retraining these folks, you know. We're going to be teaching them same paid job in a different skill. And that's better for the environment.
And that's in writing. It's not just lip service.
Right. And that's nationwide. Because for the first time in, I don't know, 50, 60 years, I don't think they've ever struck all three big three at once. And this time they did it. They acted in concert and put the pressure on the big three, and they had to cave. So labor activism. Also, remember, we had our fellow worker in Atlanta shot 57 times by the Atlanta Police Department. His name was Tortuguita, And he was protesting the construction of Cop City down there in Atlanta.
Right.
And they have come down hard on those protesters.
Aren't they calling them terrorists?
Yes.
Yeah, they're calling them eco-terrorists and all kinds of crap. And that's why they shot the poor kid 57 times, which is just insane.
Oh, they were going to prosecute these people as racketeering.
Right. Here's another ironic thing. We all, you know, got smiles on our faces when the Orange Jesus is going to be indicted down there on RICO charges, right? But the same judges and court system set the RICO investigators against the Cop City protesters.
And you are currently listening to Radio Tacoma 101.9 FM KTAH.
And the other thing that I noticed that gives me hope is people are finally understanding what solidarity means.
Yeah, how it works.
Yeah, and so I see, at least in Tacoma, and certainly in places that I'm looking all over the world, where the environmental advocates and the labor advocates and the anti-war advocates and all of these different interest groups or advocacy groups are supporting each other's causes.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the ILWU shut down West Coast ports just recently because they didn't want to support the ongoing human tragedy in Gaza.
Yeah.
So they shut down.
Which is a huge win.
It is. And that is a major labor union and one to be reckoned with. The ILWU doesn't screw around when it's time to go out on strike. So I get hope, there are coalitions forming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of climate activists that are partnering with the people that are supporting the civilians in Palestine. There's a lot of the Palestinian organizations that are also supporting the labor unions.
Right.
The World Federation of Trade Unions just made an official condemnation of the Israeli invasion of Gaza and the bombing that's been going on there and the human displacement as well. So there is this powerful coalition of rank and file organizations and people actually going out into the streets and being disruptive and protesting about all these issues at once.
That's right.
And I think it's beginning to kind of come to a mass movement stage where they do start interacting and supporting each other in their efforts. Yes,
and
fellow workers?
I'm sorry.
Well, I find that, I think that all of us do this, but I found myself like yesterday talking to a young woman that was like bagging groceries or something, but wasn't a union place. And I said, think about the future. I said, I'm not your parent, but I said, think about when you're old and you're not working anymore. If there's Social Security, which everyone hopes there will be, and we, the people who are on it, will keep fighting for it, for you guys too. But I said, think about something that has a pension, and that's a lot of union jobs. So don't just take a job, unless you have to for a while, but think about it's going to help you, and you deserve a retirement. And a lot of people cannot afford a retirement, or they have to work so late in life that it's really hard for them once they do.
It's very sad.
And so I think we can all just kind of spider out to the people. Just talk to young people.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And on one last bright note, maybe not the last bright note, I just wanted to alert the listeners that here in little old Tacoma last night, there were three separate candlelight vigils. One in front of Patty Murray's office, led by Jewish Voice for Peace activists here. One down at 311 Portland Avenue, led by the indigenous folks on behalf of not only the children lost in the residential schools, but also the children lost in Gaza. And there was a third one down at the Northwest Detention Center, our very own for-profit prison, on behalf of the people that have been incarcerated there, and they haven't even been convicted of a crime.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's got to be the worst idea ever, is a privately run prison.
Right.
That's like having a privately run army.
Three separate organizations.
And it's basically a prison against people of color.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much, yeah.
So I thought that was hopeful. And each of them, I didn't get to go to the one at the Northwest Detention Center. I did go to the one in front of Patty Murray's office. Due to my vision problems, I was unable to park and stay at the one that was Indigenous-led because it was too dark for me to see and drive safely, but I did drive by, and that was very well attended, even though it was bitter cold and raining and windy. People are getting out there. People are doing things. And as Noah said, civil disobedience is the next step.
Yes.
But certainly solidarity and gathering is a step along that road.
Mm-hmm. Find your friends and find your line of flight. Yeah.
Oh, that's a good point.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to take it anymore. It has to become our mantra. Mm-hmm. One
and,
of them.
And we have to use a variety of tactics in order to get
well, where yes, we need to go. That's it. It's not just one.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to do what speaks to you, where you can really put your heart.
Right. Absolutely.
And we're in it for the long haul. How much time we have to be in it before things collapse entirely is an unknown right now.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be doing whatever we can to maintain our spirits and our strength to stay in the struggle.
Act like it's going to happen tomorrow is kind of a good mindset for me. And that's kind of where I base a lot of my action and a lot of my organizational efforts is, you know, things are going to get worse tomorrow. What can I do right now to alleviate that harm? Or at the very least, try to prevent it from happening.
I really like that way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Find your friends and find your line of flight. And when I say line of flight, I mean find the people that are willing to engage in a common project and act in a certain direction for the same causes. Mm-hmm. Yes?
I was going to say that for people who are not from Tacoma area or who are much younger, we were talking earlier about the plant that's moving out west.
West Rock.
And how before they had it, it was very, very smelly for generations.
It was smelly afterwards, too.
And it was known as the aroma of Tacoma or the Tacoma aroma. And so that's just one thing that we were known for years and years. People would drive through. It was like, wah! So a little bit of trivia. Yeah,
but it is trivia because West Rock continued to pollute. But what they would do is they would release their pollution at night thinking that nobody could see or smell it.
But we'd smell it in the morning.
Well, we'd smell it at night. I'd go out to walk my dog and I could hardly breathe.
That's
yeah.
Nobody will notice. It's dark.
Yeah. God. Yeah, they got a special variance from the city. The city is famous for giving variances. Oh, we'll let you pollute.
Yeah.
As long as it's here on this specific land at this specific time.
And you give us this specific money.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, it's a good note to end on.
Greetings, fellow workers and fellow listeners. It's time for the monthly book review. I've done a couple of book reviews before that were pretty specific about IWW or leading lights in the IWW and our history, and I've noted with interest how they coincided and complemented each other. But I also noted that they were kind of gloomy because they ended up with the IWW being destroyed, wiped out, whatever euphemism they wanted to use. However, we still here. We didn't get the memo.
Huh.
So we're still paying dues, and there's still a national and international union of the IWW. The book I'm going to review this month tangentially hits on IWW issues, and the book is called Trying Home, The Rise and Fall of an Anarchist Utopia on Puget Sound, and the author is a young man named Justin Wadland, and he works as a librarian at the University of Washington Tacoma campus in their library. He's got a Master of Library Science from University of Washington, and a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing from Pacific Lutheran University. So this guy is hyper-local. He writes well. And it's a history book about the town called, or the colony called Home, which is on the Key Peninsula, right across the water from Tacoma. And as a matter of fact, well, up and down a couple of little inlets. But it's a highly local book. And if you like reading stuff about Puget Sound and the Tacoma, Seattle area, this is your book, because the guy writes, it's a history book and it's well researched, but it doesn't read like a history book. It reads more like a journalist report. And what the guy did, Mr. Wadland, when he wrote the book, he managed to have his buddy pick him up in a Bayliner or a boat like that, and they copied the route of the three guys who started the colony at home. These guys, Oliver Verity, a carpenter, George H. Allen, a school teacher, and Frank Odell, a blacksmith, built themselves a boat in Tacoma, tested it out, looked like it was good, so they decided to investigate available land across the sound on the home on the Key Peninsula. So they actually went through the Narrows, and this is a rowboat. They actually went through the Tacoma Narrows, which was described as having, you know, river-like currents at the change of the tide. Yeah, it's a pretty rough piece of water.
No, this is way before any Tacoma Narrows bridge.
This is 1896.
Yeah.
So it was before the bridge, which got put up the second time in 1950 or so. Well,
the first one was 47.
Right, but it's at the bottom of the Narrows.
That's when I was born.
But it's gone, and there was no bridge. And so that's another intriguing aspect of the book, because it shows what used to be very common, like mosquito fleet traffic. That's how people got mail. That's how people got provisions. People living on Fox Island and people living on various islands in the Sound and remote shores, let's put it that way, depended upon boat traffic. So these guys who started the whole thing were what I would call philosophical anarchists. They had read a lot of the European philosophy about anarchism, but they were practical guys, and they had a variety of skills, so they decided that they were going to start this colony over there at home, and it was a bang-up success for a long time, for a while anyway, until it began to get torn apart from the inside, from factional differences, although nobody knows about that on the left, right? We don't know anything about factional differences.
No such thing as leftist.
No, we're all friends and pals. No, but internal dissent, internal disagreements, right, as to how far this colony will go in anarchism, and also the usual, external spying, yeah. The Burns Detective Agency. And so, to be totally honest with you, I have not yet finished the entire book, but I'm far enough into it to really get a good flavor of what it's about, how it got started, and how it came apart. So lessons learned both ways, right? When they started, they used the basic crafts, and they would make their own clothing, and or lack of clothing, I'll get into that later. And they had their own self-sufficient orchards, and it was like a kibbutz. You know, so and then they brought their girlfriends and wives over, and eventually the colony kept building. They set up a sawmill. They immediately one of the first things they did is set up a printing press.
There you go.
And George Allen was the guy who was behind that.
They would row it over.
Yes, they would bring the paper back to Tacoma because yep. That's another part of the story.
That's eventually what got them in trouble.
Well, a couple of other things did. But what happened is that the Tacoma has apparently always had a lot of conservative interests in the governing circles, shall we say.
Oh, say that again. That was so elegant.
No, I can't say it twice. But anyway, they started this newspaper, and it was the last iteration of it was the Agitator. The first editions were of course, called Discontent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, to fan the flames of discontent. But anyway, they started building this anarchist colony, and it was becoming a success, a modest success, right? And they rode all the way to home because it was, you know, land that they could homestead, land that they could easily obtain and start building. What intrigued me was that I had heard about home, and I had heard rumors about home, that it was, you know, a bunch of bomb-throwing anarchists and... One of the later things I heard is that there was a nudist colony. Not
and
quite.
Free love and blah, blah,
free
blah.
Free love. Well, there was free love.
Yeah.
But not everybody.
Got it free.
That's right. Thank you. No, there were traditional marriages.
Yeah.
And then there were open marriages and things like that.
Yeah.
And also, I'm reading into the book a large LGBTQ population, because it was one of the few places where they could be without getting murdered. And so... that intrigued me. Also, the fact that there were colonies all over Puget Sound, up on Whidbey Island, at the head of, here's the one that was really intriguing, in the Burley Lagoon. Mm-hmm. Did you know that there was a socialist colony at the head of the Burley Lagoon at one time?
I think I'd heard about it.
Yeah, I had not.
Did you know that most of the Norwegian, the Sons of Norway halls,
yeah,
were fronts for socialist activity,
yes,
and lovely unionism?
And the Finnish hall.
Yeah.
The Finns were big on IWW.
Yeah.
They had a whole Finnish language newspaper.
That's why we've got such a strong population out here, mm-hmm, of people from
Scandinavia.
From Scandinavia. And they came out here and they brought their radical ideas with them.
That's right.
Bless their little hearts.
Well, and they brought their true anarchist practices, right? Mm-hmm. People weren't forced to work in common, like in a communist gulag. Mm-hmm. They wanted to work in
common. I want to hear more about your take on this book so far, because I've read it and I'm dying to hear what you've got to say.
Oh, well, what I'm becoming impressed with is the fact that people could start their own, what do they call it these days, intentional community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I thought that was intriguing, and that they were all over. He lists about four or five of them. And what I'm getting out of it is that it's possible to do it again.
Oh, yeah.
And with the right kind of consciousness and approach, you know, but it gets a little hairy toward, you know, where I'm at now, about 10 pages from the end. But anyway, what happened is that, and here's something interesting. They would have picnics all the time. People were curious as to these, you know, crazy anarchists on Puget Sound, so they would actually take the boat over just to look, just to, you know. And of course, the people in the colony, they served lunch. You know, they had home cooking, and they gave home cooked food.
Better way to, I mean, draw people in.
That's right. And so they really took advantage of that, got people to, you know, to take literature that they had printed themselves. And what started as, you know, just a gawky tourist thing, started to have some repercussions. For one thing, the youth, the young people, the children, if you will, of the colony, were being taunted and bullied at school. They had to go to school, and you know, and they were getting taunted and bullied by other school kids, sons and daughters of patriots, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they staged, okay, but long before that happened, because of the newspapers, and because of the... A key event was the assassination of President McKinley.
Oh, yeah.
And the guy self-identified, who did it, self-identified as an anarchist. His name was Czolgosz. And he self-identified as an anarchist. They strung him up within a couple of months of the attempt.
And then it started the witch hunts against,
yes,
communists,
that's it,
anarchists, IWW, any group of people that didn't think the way the patriots thought.
That's right. And you can see almost exact parallels today. That's what's intriguing to me about the book, that the face of oppression, you know, doesn't change much over the centuries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always the same people who own stuff who want to suppress any kind of political free will. So the upshot of the deal was that they lost their post office. They had their own postmistress, and home was the home post office, you know, handles the U.S. mail. Well, through government skullduggery and bureaucracy, They lost the post office and had to send their mail and receive their mail in Lake Bay,
mm-hmm,
which was you know, a couple of miles away.
The Olala post office.
Really? Yeah. Olala also?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe that's in the part I didn't read yet. But they had to move their post office, so they lost that aspect of it. And then because of the taunting and the bullying of the school kids, there was an internal revolt.
Mm-hmm.
They had a 4th of July celebration, and they had pictures of Bakunin and pictures of Kropotkin and all these old school, you know, European anarchists. The kids came up into the meeting hall that they had, tore up all the posters. This is the kids that come from home.
Mm-hmm.
Tore up all the posters, put up American flags, said they want to be normal. They were tired of being raised.
Oh, those kids.
Oh, those
always
kids
rebel
today.
Against the parents.
I know. But it's
ironic, but continue.
It is ironic, but also kind of understandable. I had friends who I call red diaper babies because they were. And
they better explain that term to the listener.
Red diaper babies are the children of known Communist Party activists in the United States. And I went to high school with a couple of them. And Danny's sister, the school I went to was all boys until 1970. It was a public high school, but it was all boys because it was a science and technology high school.
Which was sexist as crazy.
Yep, indeed. But anyway, Danny's sister wrote a thing. They can all write. And she called it Growing Up Commie. And it was just as onerous. For instance, Danny Spector, they're both Ashkenazi Jewish family, right? Danny got beat up by the JDL mm-hmm. from time to time. They would chase him down, beat him up. The Jewish Defense League, they were a very radical group in New York. They still are. Meyer Kahane and the boys.
But we're digressing a little bit.
Yes, we are. So my take on the book is that, first of all, if you just like a nice history story, read it. It's got some salacious interest for those who want that, because the colonists like to go nude bathing. And that's what started the whole, they're a bunch of indecent exposure people, and they actually got taken to court in Tacoma, and they sort of started, they created factionalism in the home colony. The nudes and the prudes, they called themselves. And so, you know, it's interesting, just historically, but you can see how people can be manipulated, and how this wonderful colony that was self-sufficient crumbled from the inside and also got pressured from the outside. So it doesn't exactly end on a high note, but it does tell me that these kind of ventures are possible again, and we can do it. It takes intent, and it takes learning the lessons of the past and forging new ways toward the future, and I think we can do it again.
I have two comments. Number one, thank you. It's a very good read. Number two, the Key Center Library has original manuscripts from home.
Really?
That we should go out and do a little field trip mm-hmm. and look at. Just make an appointment first. They'll make those available. The librarian contacted me about that.
Good.
Number three.
That would be a good field trip.
I was at Evergreen Tacoma when Occupy was happening as a movement.
Right, 2011.
And I did an independent study. And I did some field work and papers on the comparison between the home cooperative community, anarchist community, and the Occupy movement.
Interesting. Good
and
parallel.
One of the things that I was able to see after the so-called ending of the Occupy movement was where and how it did not die and branched into other
right.
movement work that continues on to this day.
Mm-hmm.
And the home colony, the cooperative movement, although it was smashed and certainly wasn't very discernible for a while, there are remnants of it yet.
Really?
Yeah.
That'd be interesting to see, because I made a trip down there several years ago by myself.
Let's go.
Without knowing.
Let's do a field trip.
Yeah, we should. Because the gentleman who wrote this book, fellow worker Wadlin, mm-hmm. who wrote this book, depended pretty much on the newspaper archives, and couldn't, you know, there were holes in the historical gap, and you know, he did the best research that he could,
mm-hmm.
but without actually being an anarchist himself, I think,
right,
and without being a wobbly, you know, he did sort of like reporting from the outside of the
fishbowl.
Well,
did you know that community initially started up toward Mount Rainier at a much higher altitude?
Mm-mm, I didn't.
And they came down because they couldn't really farm up there.
Aha.
So they came down to where the living was a little easier. They could fish and they could farm.
Well, they also had to clear the timber. I mean, picture the first growth timber that they cut down, mm-hmm. and they used that as their principal resource at first. They set up a mill, and so they cut their own boards and they cut their own planks and they went to town on that.
Mm-hmm.
They built the town on that. So.
So if there's a field trip there, what are you going to be looking for?
We're going to be asking to see the papers, the original papers.
Right. Or if we could get facsimiles of them. That's just okay. good material
to
have.
Well, we first want
to
see them.
I misunderstood. I remember hearing about the Key Center Library mm-hmm. having the documents from out there. But then I thought, you said there's still remnants of the colony. And I thought you said, let's do a field trip. So I was thinking, how are we going to find those people?
Well, the interesting device that the author employed was that he actually took a boat with his buddy over there, right? And so he cruised the same route, and he interweaves that. He goes from 1910 to 2010.
I thought it was a wonderful book.
Yeah, it's a very good read. If you're not a historian or if you just like a good tale, it's a good book. And for local people, it's great. Because I love reading stuff about Puget Sound and Washington State.
Absolutely.
I love it. It just because, oh yeah, I know that place.
I'm really glad you're reading that book. Thank you for the report because you got me excited again.
So just to give a shout out to our fellow listeners, where you can find the Tacoma branch of the IWW if you're interested in learning more about us, maybe becoming a union member, maybe organizing your workplace and getting a union in your workplace. If you go to the IWW.org webpage, there is a branch search tab on the website. You can look us up by branch in your local area, whether you live in Bellingham, that's the Wacom-Skagit branch up there. There's the Seattle branch, and of course, there's us, the Tacoma branch here in Tacoma. So you can go onto the branch search application on the IWW.org website. You can use the email that's posted there to reach out to us if you're interested in joining or interested in organizing your workplace. As for WOB Radio, we have an official Facebook page that's just WOB Radio. We try to do regular updates about local activism that's going on. We post or update our viewers on when our episodes get posted online. That will be at Radio Tacoma, 101.9 FM. We also broadcast out of 94.9 KZAX up in Bellingham and 95.3 KTQA from Hilltop. And, of course, we appreciate all of our listeners that tune in when WOB Radio is playing. So,
and WOB is spelled W-O-B.
Thank you very much.
If you're not too anti-Facebook, to go on to the WOB Radio Facebook site, I do look at that occasionally. And if you express an interest in getting more involved, I will get back to you.
Absolutely, as will I. Marilyn and I are both delegates of the branch. We specify in educating fellow workers and getting them signed up into the union.
And just raising a little hell.
That's absolutely. Yes, fellow worker Gordon?
Just want to give a shout out to our local fellow worker who's fallen ill, fellow worker Keith. We're all pulling for you, bud.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fellow worker Keith was a longtime contributor to WOB Radio who has recently fallen ill. His current path to treatment is pretty long and pretty hard, but yeah. We certainly think about him every time we get together, and we wish him all the best.
And we also want to do a shout-out to Al. If you can hear us, Al, we kept the potato soup warm for you, but you never showed up. Come to the next one.
Absolutely.
And we're having that fundraiser on December 9th.
Thank you so much for reminding me. The Tacoma IWW branch will be having a fundraiser on December 9th. Coming up here soon, we'll post about it on the WOB Radio Facebook page. This will be a fundraiser for the Tacoma branch as well as for Hilltop Solidarity, which is the outfit that we currently have our regular meetings at the end of every month. We will also be gathering food donations for the People's Assembly as well.
And on December 15th at the First United Methodist Church at 7-something Tacoma Avenue, there is 721 Tacoma Avenue. We are doing, several of us are involved in a fundraiser concert for the World Kitchen. And that is a wonderful outfit that does food, meals, feeding for not just the Ukrainians and the Palestinians, but also Haitians and other groups that are experiencing lack of food, food insecurity, war.
Right.
All of the above.
Natural disasters.
That is December 15th. It is at 5 o'clock. And Gary Cantor, who is a wonderful labor singer, will be there. Also, Steve and Christy Niebel. And there may be some other groups, too. And that is by donation, 721 Tacoma Avenue, December 15th. At 5 o'clock.
Thank you once again for all tuning in to listen in to WOB Radio. We thank all of our broadcasters out there that are helping carry our message, and we'll see you again next month. Solidarity.
Solidarity.
Solidarity. Solidarity.